menace in his voice. Shevik said, "Jack Reacher, how do we know you're not Aaron Shevik's dad? We would have the same name. Father-in-law, then. How do we know he's not in the house right now? Maybe you took over the lease and he squats in a room. We know he's not exactly swimming in cash right now." Shevik said nothing. The same voice said, "We're coming in to take a look." There was the sound of Shevik getting shoved aside, and then footsteps in the hallway. Reacher stood up and moved behind the kitchen door. He opened a drawer, and another, until he found a cooking knife. Better than nothing. He heard Abby and Maria move out of the living room and into the hallway. The footsteps kept on coming. He heard Abby say, "Who are you?" "We're looking for Mr. Aaron Shevik," one of the guys said.
"Who?
What's your name?"
"Abigail," Abby said.
"Abigail what?"
"Reacher," she said. "These are my grandparents, Jack and Joanna."
"Where's Shevik?"
"He was the last tenant. He moved out."
"Where did he go?"
"He didn't leave a forwarding address. He gave the impression he was having serious financial problems. I think basically he skipped in the night. He ran away."
"You sure?"
"I know who lives here, mister. This is a two-bedroom house, one for my grandparents and one for me when I'm here, for guests when I'm not. There are no squatters. I think I would have noticed."
"Did you ever meet him?"
"Who?"
"Mr. Aaron Shevik."
"No."
"I met him," Maria Shevik said, "when we first saw the house." "What did he look like?"
"I remember him as being tall and powerfully built."
"That's the guy," the voice said. "How long has he been gone?"
"About a year."
No response. The footsteps moved on to the living room door. The voice said, "You've been here a year, and you don't have a TV yet."
"We're retired," Maria said. "These things are expensive."
The voice said, "Huh." Reacher heard a quiet, scratchy click. Then the footsteps retreated, back down the hallway, to the front door, to the front step, to the narrow concrete path. Reacher heard the car start up, and then he heard it drive away, the soft hiss and squelch of a big sedan. Silence came back. He put the knife in its place in the drawer, and he stepped out of the kitchen. "Nice work, everyone," he said. Aaron looked shaky. Maria looked pale.
"They took a photograph," Abby said, "like a parting shot."
Reacher nodded. The quiet, scratchy click. A cell phone, imitating a camera. "A photograph of what?" he said.
"The three of us. Partly for their report. Partly for their just-in-case database. But mostly to intimidate. It's what they do. People feel vulnerable."
Reacher nodded again. He remembered the luminous guy in the bar, raising his phone. The little snitch of a sound. "If I was a real client, I wouldn't have liked it." The Sheviks stepped into the kitchen to make more coffee. Reacher and Abby went to the living room to wait for it. Abby said,
"Intimidation is not the only issue with that photograph."
"What else?" Reacher said.
"They'll text the picture, among themselves. That's what they do. In case someone can fill in another part of the puzzle. Sooner or later, everyone will get the text. The guy on the door at work will get it. He knows I'm not Abigail Reacher. He knows I'm Abby Gibson. So do a lot of other guys on a lot of other doors because I've worked a lot of other places. They'll start asking questions. They already don't like me."
"Do they know where you live?"
"I'm sure they could make my boss tell them."
"When will they send the text?"
"I'm sure they already have."
"Is there someplace else you could stay?"
She nodded. "I have a friend," she said, "east of Center Street. Albanian territory, happily."
"Can you work there?"
"I have before."
Reacher said, "I sincerely apologize for the disruption."
"I'm thinking of it as an experiment," she said.
"Someone once told me that every day a woman should do something that scared her." She could join the army,
You need to be based east of center anyway. We can stick together. At least tonight.
Will that be okay with your friend?
I hope so, she said. Will the Sheviks be okay tonight?
Reacher nodded. People believe their own eyes, he said. In this case, their own eyes were the luminous guys in the bar. He met me. His phone took my picture. I am Aaron Shevik. It's set in stone. In their minds, Shevik is a big, tall guy from a younger generation. You could tell by the things they said. They accused him of being Shevik's dad or his father-in-law, but they never accused him of being Shevik himself. So they'll be okay. As far as those guys are concerned, they're just an old couple named Reacher. Then Maria called through to say the coffee was ready. The manager of the grimy pawn shop across the narrow street from the taxi dispatcher and the bail bond office came out the door and dodged a truck and ducked into the taxi place. He ignored the weary guy on the radio and pushed on through to the back, to Gregory's outer office. Gregory's right-hand man looked up and asked him what he wanted. He said something had happened. Quicker to walk it across the street than put it in a text.
Put what in a text? The right-hand man asked. This morning, I got an alert and a photograph about a man named Shevik, a big ugly son of a bitch. Have you seen him? Is Shevik a common name in America?
Why?
I had a client named Shevik this morning, but a small old woman.
Possibly related. Possibly an elderly aunt or cousin. The guy nodded.
That's what I thought, he said. But then I got another alert and another photograph. The same old woman is in it, but her name is different. In the new alert, they're calling her Joanna Reacher. But this morning, for me, she signed Maria Shevik.
Chapter 19. Reacher and Abby left the Sheviks in their kitchen and headed out to the Toyota. Reacher was already packed. His toothbrush was in his pocket. But Abby wanted to drop by her place to pick up some stuff, which was reasonable. In turn, Reacher decided he wanted to drop by the Public Law Project to get an answer to a question. Both destinations were in Ukrainian territory. But it would be safe enough, he thought. Possibly. On the downside, there were two photographs out there, plus potentially the Toyota's description and license plate. On the upside, it was broad daylight, and they would be in and out real fast. Safe enough, he thought. Possibly. They drove in through the still shabby blocks, and he found the law project again near the hotels, just west of center, at the end of its gentrified street, which had a different feel by day than night. All the other offices were open. People were going in and out. There were cars parked both sides on the curb, but no black Lincolns and no unexplained pale men in suits. Safe enough? Possibly. Abby backed into a space and parked. She and Reacher got out and walked to the door. Only two guys were at their desks. No sign of Isaac Mahay Byford. Just Julian Harvey Wood and Gino Vettoretto. Harvard and Yale. Good enough. They greeted Reacher and shook Abby's hand and said they were pleased to meet her. Reacher said, "What if Max Trulenko has hidden money stashed away?"
"That's Isaac's theory," Gino said. "There's always a rumor like that," Julian said.
"I think this time it's true," Reacher said. "Last night I dropped Trulenko's name to the doorman where Abby works. About 3 minutes later, four guys showed up in two cars, which was a pretty impressive response. It was platinum-level protection. These guys don't do anything except for cash. Therefore, Trulenko is paying them. Top dollar to get four guys in two cars inside 3 minutes. Therefore, he still has money of his own."
"What happened with the four guys?" Gino asked.
"They lost me," Reacher said. "But along the way, I think they might have proved Isaac's point."
"Do you know where Trulenko is?" Julian asked.
"Not precisely."
We would need an address to serve the papers, and to get his bank accounts frozen. How much money do you suppose he has?
I have no idea, Reacher said. More than me, I'm sure. More than the Sheviks, I'm damn sure.
I guess we would sue him for $100 million and settle for whatever he has left. With a bit of luck, it will be enough.
Reacher nodded. Then he asked what he had come to ask. He said, how long would all that take?
Gino said, they would never go to court. They couldn't afford to. They know they would lose. They would settle ahead of a trial. They would beg us to let them. It would be lawyer to lawyer, back and forth, mostly by email. The only issue would be letting Trulenko keep a couple cents on the dollar, so he doesn't have to live under a bridge the rest of his life.
How long would all that take? Reacher asked again.
6 months, Julian said. Certainly no more than that.
The law moves slow, Maria Shevik had said many times. No way of hurrying it along?
That is hurrying it along.
Okay, Reacher said. Say hey to Isaac for me.
They hustled back to the Toyota. It was still there, unnoticed, unwatched, unsurrounded, and unticketed. They got in. Abby said, it's like one movie is playing in slow motion, and the other one is running all speeded up.
Reacher said nothing. Abby's place was close by in terms of physical distance, but it was three sides of a square away in terms of one-way streets. They came on it from the north. There was a car outside the door, parked on the curb, a black Lincoln facing away. It had dark glass in the rear compartment. From a distance, it was impossible to tell who was inside.
Pull over, Reacher said.
Abby stopped 30 yards north of the Lincoln. Reacher said, worst case, there are two guys in it, and I bet their doors are locked.
What would the army tell you to do?
Fire armor-piercing rounds in sufficient quantity to subdue resistance, and then fire tracer at the gas tank in sufficient quantity to subdue evidence.
We can't do that.
Sadly. But we better do something. That's your house. They're poking their noses where they don't belong.
Safer to ignore them, surely.
Only in the short term, Reacher said. We can't let them have it all their own way. We need to send a message. They're out of line. They squeezed your address out of an innocent couple with enough taste to hire you and book that band. They need to know there are certain things they shouldn't do. And they need to know they're messing with the wrong people. We need to scare them a little bit.
Abby was quiet a beat. You're nuts, she said. You're one guy. You can't take them on.
Someone has to. I'm used to it. I was a military policeman. I got all the lousy jobs. She was quiet another beat.
Your concern is their doors are locked, she said. Because if they are, you can't get to them.
Correct, Reacher said.
I could walk around the block and go in the back door. I could turn on all the lights inside. That might get them out of the car for you.
No, Reacher said.
Okay. I could leave the lights off and at least get my stuff.
No, Reacher said again. For the same reason. They might be waiting inside the house. The car could be empty. Or one and one.
That's creepy.
I told you. There are certain things they shouldn't do.
I could live without my stuff. I mean, you do. It's clearly possible. It could be part of the experiment.
No, Reacher said again. It's a free country. If you want your stuff, you should have it. And if they need a message, they should get one.
Okay. Works for me. But how do we do it?
That depends on how experimental you want to be.
What do you want me to do?
I'm pretty sure it will work out fine.
What will?
But you'll probably worry about it ahead of time.
Try me.
Ideally, I would like you to drive up behind the Lincoln and nudge it in the back bumper at about walking pace.
Why?
The doors will unlock. For the first responders. The car will think it's in a minor accident. There's a little doodad in there somewhere, a safety mechanism.
So then you can open the doors from the outside. That would be the first tactical objective. All else would follow. They might have guns. For a limited period only, after which I would have them. What if the guys are in the house? I suppose we could set the car on fire. That would send a message.
That's crazy.
Let's take it one step at a time.
Will my car get wrecked?
It has federal bumpers. Should be good up to 5 miles an hour. Conceivable you could need another electrical tie.
Okay,
she said. Remember to keep your foot on the clutch pedal. You don't want to stall out. You want to be ready to reverse away.
Then what?
You park and go get your stuff, while I tell the guys in the car what they need to do.
Which is what?
Follow you to some dubious place east of center. After that, it's up to them. She was quiet, another long beat. Then she nodded, a bob of her short dark hair, a gleam in her eye, a smile on her lips, half grim, half excited.
Okay, she said again. Let's do it.
At that moment, Gregory's right-hand man was laying out what little he knew. He was in the inner office, across the desk from his boss, which was an intimidating place to be. The desk was massive, ornately carved from toffee-colored wood. The desk chair was huge, made of tufted green leather. Behind the chair was a tall, heavy bookcase that matched the desk. Altogether imposing. Not a comfortable place to be when telling a confusing story. He said, "At 6 o'clock last night, Aaron Shevik was a big, ugly, sad sack nobody paying back a loan. At 8, he was a big, ugly, sad sack nobody taking out a new loan. But at 10, he was different. He was a man about town, enjoying the band, flirting with the waitress, eating bite-sized pizzas and drinking $6 cups of coffee. Then on the way out of the bar, he was different again. He was a tough guy, talking about Max Trulenko. He's like three people in one. We have no idea who he really is."
Gregory asked, "Who do you think he is?"
His guide didn't answer. Instead, he said, "Meanwhile, we dug up his last known address. But he wasn't there. He moved out a year ago. The new tenants are an old retired couple named Jack and Joanna Reacher. Their granddaughter was visiting. Her name is Abigail Reacher. Except it isn't. Her name is Abigail Gibson. She's the waitress Shevik was flirting with last night. We know all about her. She's a troublemaker."
"How so?"
"A year or so ago, she told the police about something she saw. We straightened it out. We showed her the error of her ways. She promised to reform, which is why we let her keep working."
Gregory bent his neck to the left and held it, and to the right and held it, as if it was hurting. He said, "But now she's flirting with Shevik and showing up at his last known address under a phony name."
"It gets worse," his guy said. "Grandma Reacher was in our pawn shop this morning, but she signed her name Shevik."
"Really?"
"Maria Shevik."
"And then she showed up at Aaron Shevik's last known address."
"We have no idea who these people really are."
"Who do you think they are?" Gregory asked again.
"We didn't get where we are by being stupid," his guy said. "We should consider every possibility. Start with Abigail Gibson. We're getting a new police commissioner. Maybe he's getting a jump on reading the files. Her name is in there. Maybe he reached out. Maybe he put the big guy in the field to work with her.
He's not commissioner yet."
"All the more reason. We think we're still safe."
Gregory said, "You think Shevik is a cop?"
"No," his guy said. "We know the cops. We would have heard. Someone would have talked to us."
"Then who is he?"
"Maybe he's FBI. Maybe the police department asked for outside help."
"No," Gregory said. "A new commissioner wouldn't do that. He would want his own people on the job.
He would want all the glory for himself. Then maybe he's an ex-cop or ex-FBI, and Dino hired him to mess with us.
No,
Gregory said again. Same as the new commissioner. Dino wouldn't hire outside help. He doesn't trust anyone enough, like we don't.
Then who is he?
He's a guy who borrowed money and then asked about Max, which I agree is an odd combination.
What do you want to do about him?
Watch the house you found, Gregory said. If he lives there, he'll show up sooner or later.
Abby kept her seatbelt on. Reacher took his off. He braced his palm against the dash. She put the gear stick in first.
Ready? She said.
Walking speed, he said. It's going to seem awful fast when you get there, but don't slow down. Maybe better to close your eyes for the last bit. She pulled away from the curb and rolled down the street.
Chapter 20. Walking speed was customarily reckoned to be about 3 miles an hour, which was about 270 feet a minute, so it took the battered white Toyota 20 whole agonizing seconds to close the gap on the parked Lincoln. Abby lined it up and took a nervous breath and held it and closed her eyes. The Toyota rolled on unchecked and smacked hard into the Lincoln's back bumper. Walking speed, but still a big noisy impact. Abby was thrown forward against her belt. Reacher used both hands on the dash. The Lincoln bucked forward a foot. The Toyota bounced backward a foot. Reacher stumbled out, one fast pace, two, three, straight ahead to the Lincoln's rear right-hand door. He grabbed the handle. The safety doodad had done its work. The door opened. There were two guys inside, elbow to elbow in the front, belts off, reclined. Recently comfortable, now a little shaken up and bounced around. Their heads had come to rest on their seat backs, which made them waist high to Reacher as he slid in behind them, which made them easy to grab, one in each palm, which made them easy to crash together like the guy in back of the orchestra with the cymbals. And again, after a little more bouncing around, and then ramrod straight forward, the left-hand guy into the rim of the steering wheel, and the right-hand guy into the dashboard roll above the glove box. Then it was both hands inside their suit coats, leaning over their shoulders from the rear compartment, searching, finding leather straps and shoulder holsters and pistols, which he took. He found nothing more in their waistbands, and leaning all the way forward, he found nothing more strapped around their ankles. He sat back. The pistols were H&K P7s, German police issue, beautifully engineered, almost delicate, but also steely and hard-edged. Therefore manly. Reacher said, "Wake up now, guys." He waited. Through the window, he saw Abby step through her door into her house. "Wake up, guys," he said again. And they did, soon enough. They came back, groggy and blinking, looking around, trying to piece it together. Reacher said, "Here's the deal. There's an incentive attached. You're going to drive me east. Along the way, I'm going to ask you questions. If you lie to me, I'll feed you to the Albanians when we get there. If you tell me the truth, I'll get out and walk away and let you turn around and drive home again unharmed. That's the incentive. Take it or leave it. Are we clear?" He saw Abby come out of her house with a bulging bag. She heaved it across the sidewalk to her car. She dumped it in the back. She got in the front. Inside the Lincoln, the guy behind the wheel clutched his head and said,
"Are you crazy? I can't even see straight. I can't drive you anywhere now."
"No such word," Reacher said. "My advice is try very hard." He buzzed down his window and stuck his arm out and signaled Abby to go ahead and pull around and lead the way. He watched her hesitant maneuver. The Toyota's front fender was no longer horizontal. It was hanging down diagonally, way lower than it should have been. The passenger side corner was about an inch away from scraping on the blacktop. Maybe two electrical ties would be required. Possibly three. "Follow that car," he said.
The guy behind the Lincoln's wheel took off as clumsy as a first-timer. Beside him, his partner craned around as far as a cricked neck would let him, and he looked out the corner of his eye, straight at Reacher, who said nothing. Up ahead, the battered white Toyota was making good progress, heading east on the cross streets. The Lincoln followed behind it. The guy at the wheel got better at driving, much smoother. Reacher said, "Where is Max Trulenko?" At first, neither one of them spoke. Then the guy with the bad neck said,
"You're a lousy cheat."
"How so?" Reacher said.
"What our own people would do to us if we told you Trulenko's location is worse than anything the Albanians could do to us, which makes it a phony choice. It's not an incentive. Plus, we're guys who sit in cars and watch doors. You think they would tell folks like us where Trulenko is? So the truthful answer is we don't know, which you will say is a lie, which makes it another phony choice, not an incentive. So do what you got to do. Just spare us the pious bullshit along the way."
"But you know who Trulenko is."
"Of course we do."
"And you know someone is hiding him somewhere."
"No comment."
"But you don't know where."
"No comment."
"If your life depended on it, where would you look?" The guy with the neck didn't answer. Then the driver's cell phone rang in his pocket. A jaunty little marimba tune plinking away over and over, muffled. Reacher thought about coded warnings and secret SOS alerts, and he said, "Don't answer it." The driver said,
"They'll come looking for us."
"Who will?"
"They'll send a couple of guys."
"Like you two? Now I'm really scared." No answer. The phone stopped. Reacher asked, "What's your boss's name?"
"Our boss?"
"Not the boss of sitting in cars watching doors. The top boy. The capo di tutti capi."
"What does that mean?"
"Italian," Reacher said. "The boss of all bosses." No response. Not at first. They glanced at each other, as if trying to share a mute decision. How far could they go? On the one hand, omerta, also Italian, a code of absolute silence, a code to live by and to die for. On the other hand, they were currently in deep trouble, personally and individually, in the real world, in the here and now. Dying for a code was all well and good in theory. In practice, things were different. Right then, number one on their to-do list was not honorable or glorious sacrifice, but living long enough to drive home afterward. The guy with the neck said,
"Gregory."
"That's his name?"
"In English."
Then they glanced at each other again. Different looks. Some new discussion. "How long have you been over here?" Reacher asked. Because he wanted them back on track. Because answering questions eventually became a habit. Start with the easy ones, and work up to the hard ones. A basic interrogation technique. Again, the two guys shared a glance, seeking each other's permission. On the one hand, and on the other hand.
8 years we have been here, the driver said.
Your English is pretty good.
Thank you.
Then the other guy's phone rang, the guy with the neck, also in his pocket, equally muffled, but a different tone, a digital reproduction of an old-fashioned electric telephone bell, like in the money-lending bar, on the wall behind the fat guy, a long, muted, mournful peal, and then another. "Don't answer it," Reacher said.
"They can track us with them,"
the guy said. "Doesn't matter. They can't react quickly enough. My guess is, 2 minutes from now all this will be over. You'll be heading home anyway." A third muffled peal, and a fourth. "Or not," Reacher said. "Maybe 2 minutes from now the Albanians will have you. Either way, it's going to happen fast." Up ahead, the Toyota slowed and pulled in at the curb. The Lincoln stopped behind it. On a block with old brick buildings and old brick sidewalks and old bricks showing under pocked blacktop on the street. Two-thirds of the buildings were closed down and boarded up, and the open third seemed to be conducting no kind of reputable business. some dubious place east of center. Abby had chosen well. The phone stopped ringing. Reacher leaned way over and turned the motor off and pulled the key. He sat back. They turned to look at him, a P7 in his left hand and the car key in his right. He said, "If your life depended on it, where would you look for Max Trulenko?" No response. More glances, both kinds. At first, apprehensive and rock and a hard place, frustrated, like before, and then different. The new discussion. The guy with the neck said, "They'll be suspicious of us. They'll want to know how come we were brought all the way out here and then let go again." I agree. It's a matter of perception. That's the problem. They'll assume we traded something. Tell them the truth. That would be suicide. A version of the truth, Reacher said. Carefully selected and curated. Some parts redacted. But all of it still absolutely true in itself. Tell them a woman came out the door you were watching with a bag of stuff and she got in a car and you followed her here. Give them any address on this block. Tell them you figured if Gregory thought the house was worth watching, he would certainly like to know where the missing occupant was currently hiding out. Be a little aw shucks about it. You'll get a pat on the head and a gold star for initiative. The driver said, "Not mention you at all?" Always safer that way. More glances at each other, looking for holes in the cover story, not finding any. Then turning back and looking at Reacher again. The gun rock steady in his left hand, the car key tiny in his right. He said, "Where would a sensible fellow start the search?" The two guys turned to the front and glanced at each other again, still apprehensive, but then a little bolder, and bolder still as they talked themselves into it. They weren't being asked for facts, after all. They hadn't been trusted with facts. Not lowly people like them. They were being asked for an opinion. That was all. Where would a sensible fellow look? Pure hypothetical speculation. Third-party commentary. Just polite conversation, really. And of course flattering to a lowly person that his opinion was sought at all. Reacher watched the process. He saw the boldness build. He saw the firming of jaws and the drawing of breaths and the filling of lungs, ready to talk, both physically and figuratively, but ready for something else, too. Something bad. The new discussion. Some crazy idea. It was coming off them like a smell. The fault was his own, completely, because of the phony choice. The guy was right. And because of the question about the capo. No doubt a scary figure, capable of terrible retributions. And because of the happy conclusion to the cover story, the pat on the head and the gold star. The wrong thing to say to frustrated, ambitious people. It got them thinking. Pats on the head and gold stars were great. But better still was promotion and status. And after 8 long years, best of all, would be finally getting out of sitting in cars watching doors. They wanted to move up the ladder, which they knew would take more than following a girl to an address. They would need a greater achievement. Capturing Aaron Shevik would qualify, which was who they thought he was, obviously. They had gotten texts, the same as everyone, the description and the photograph. They hadn't asked who he was. Most people would. They would say, "Who the hell are you? What do you want?" But these guys had shown no curiosity at all, because they already knew. He was a guy they got texts about, therefore important, therefore a prize, therefore crazy ideas. His own fault. "Don't do it," he thought. Out loud, he said, "Don't do it." The driver said, "Do what?" "Anything stupid." They paused a beat. He guessed they would start by telling him something true. Too hard to coordinate a lie with silent glances.
It would be like a teaser. It would be something that required a couple seconds of thought, and then the careful formulation of a follow-up question. All to make him momentarily preoccupied, to give them time to jump him. The guy with the neck would corkscrew over from the front and land with his chest on Reacher's left arm, and his hips on Reacher's right arm, whereupon the driver would come over the top and attack his undefended head. With his cell phone, edge on if he had any sense, and no inhibitions about smashing up a precision piece of electronics. Which most people were willing to do, in Reacher's experience, when their lives depended on it. Don't do it, he thought. Out loud, he said, where would you look for Max Trulenko? The driver said, where he works, of course. Reacher put a momentarily blank look on his face, but inside he was thinking of nothing and formulating no follow-up questions. He was just waiting. Time passed in quarter-second beats, like a racing heart. At first, nothing, then still nothing. Then the guy with the neck launching, hard and clumsy, his arms spearing out ahead of him, his feet thrusting, his back arching, aiming to get most of his bulk beyond the point of no return, so that even if he landed on the seat back, gravity would do the rest of his work for him, dumping him into Reacher's lap in an undignified but equally effective manner. He didn't get to the point of no return. Reacher jammed the gun against the seat back and shot the guy through the upholstery. Then he repelled the falling corpse with his elbow, like a double tap. One, two, gunshot, elbow. The shot was loud, but not terrible. The interior of the thick Lincoln seat squab had acted like a huge suppressor. All kinds of wool and horsehair in there, all kinds of cotton batting. Natural absorption. One minor problem. Some of it had caught on fire. Plus, the driver was leaning forward, leaning down, feeling under the dashboard near his shins, then coming back up and twisting around. In his hand was a tiny pocket gun, maybe Russian, secured out of sight with hook and loop tape. Reacher shot him through his own seat back. It caught on fire, too. A 9mm round, the muzzle hard against the padding, a massive explosion of superheated gases. Maybe never taken into account during Lincoln's design process. Reacher opened the door and slid out to the sidewalk. He put the guns in his pocket. Fresh air blew inside the car and the tiny fires perked up. Not just smoldering. There were actual flames. Small, like a lady's fingernail, dancing inside the seats. Abby said, "What happened?" She was standing near her own car, very still on the sidewalk, looking in through the Lincoln's windshield. Reacher said, they showed extraordinary loyalty to an organization that doesn't seem to treat them very well. You shot them? Self-defense. How? They blinked first. Are they dead? We might need to give them another minute. Depends how fast they're bleeding. She said, this has never happened to me before. He said, I'm sorry it had to. You killed two people. I warned them. I told them not to. All my cards were on the table. It was more like assisted suicide. Think of it that way. Did you do it for me? She asked. I told you I wanted them messed up. I didn't want to do it at all, he said. I wanted to send them home safe and sound. But no. They tried their best. I guess they did what I would have done. Although I hope I would have done it better. What should we do about it? The flames were licking higher. The vinyl on the seat backs was bubbling and splitting and peeling, like skin. Reacher said, we should get in your car and drive away. Just like that? For me, it's all about the shoe on the other foot. What would they do for me? That's what sets the bar. She was quiet a beat. Then she said, okay, get in the car. She drove. He sat in the passenger seat. His extra weight on that side dipped the suspension down just enough that the old Toyota's newly falling off fender banged against the blacktop now and then, unpredictable and irregular, like spaced out Morse code played on a bass drum, all the way along their route.
Chapter 21. No one would dream of calling the cops about a burning car on a two-thirds abandoned block on the east side of the city. Such a thing was obviously someone else's private business, and obviously best kept that way. But plenty of people dreamed about calling Dino's people. Always. About anything that might be useful. But especially about news like this. It might get them ahead. It might make their names. Some of them made dangerous up-close inspections, flinching away from the heat. They saw burning bodies inside. They wrote down the license plate before the flames consumed it. They called Dino's people and told them it was a Ukrainian car on fire. It was the type of Lincoln they used west of center. As far as anyone could tell, the two bodies in it were dressed in suits and ties, which was standard practice over there. Looked like they had been shot in the back, which was standard practice everywhere. Case closed. They were the enemy. At which point, Dino himself took over.
"Let it burn," he said.
While it did, he called his inner council together, in back of the lumberyard, which a few of them didn't like, because lumber was combustible and something somewhere was currently on fire, maybe throwing sparks. But they all came, his right-hand man and his other top boys. No choice.
"Did we do this?" Dino asked them.
"No," his right-hand man said. "This is not ours."
"Are you sure?"
"By now everyone knows about the massage parlor. Everyone knows we're 4 for 4. Honors even, game over. We have no rogues or mavericks or private business. I guarantee that. I would have heard."
"Then explain this to me."
No one could.
"At least the practical details," Dino said, "if not the actual meaning."
One of his guys said,
"Maybe they drove in to have a meeting. Their contact was waiting on the sidewalk. He got in the back seat to chat, but he shot them instead. Maybe threw in a burning rag."
"What contact waiting on the sidewalk?"
"I don't know."
"A local person?"
"Probably."
"One of our guys?"
"Could be."
"Like an anonymous snitch?"
"It's possible."
"So anonymous, we never noticed him before. So furtive, he escaped our attention all these years?"
"I don't think so. I think such a master of tradecraft would be waiting in a coffee shop on Center Street. He would be talking to some random kid in a hoodie. He wouldn't let two men in suits in a town car anywhere near him. Not within a million miles. Especially not all the way out in this part of town. He might as well publish a confession in the newspaper. So it wasn't a meeting."
"Okay. And why would he shoot them?"
"I don't know."
Another guy said, "Then the shooter must have been in the back seat all along. They drove out here as a threesome. Therefore, the shooter is one of them."
"Has to be.
You don't let an armed man ride behind you unless you know him."
"Where is he now?"
"He got out, and maybe a second car picked him up. Something anonymous. Not another town car. Someone would have seen it leaving."
"How many people in the second car?"
"Two, I'm sure. They always work in pairs."
"Therefore, overall, not a small operation," Dino said. "It must have required a certain amount of resources and planning and coordination and secrecy. 5 guys drove out here. I assume 2 of them didn't know what was about to happen."
"I guess not."
"But why did it happen? What was the strategic objective?"
"I don't know."
"Why did he set the car on fire?"
"I don't know,"
the guy said again. Dino looked around the table. He asked,
"Do we all agree the shooter was in the back seat all along and therefore was one of them?"
Everyone nodded, most of them gravely, as if coming to a weighty conclusion made inevitable by many hours of deliberation.
and then after he shot the guys in the front seats, we know he set the car on fire.
More nods, this time faster and brisker, because some things were self-evident.
Why all that?
Dino asked. No one answered. No one could.
It feels like myth and legend, Dino said. It feels highly symbolic, like the Vikings burning their warriors in their boats, like a ceremonial funeral pyre, like a ritual sacrifice. It feels like Gregory is making an offering to us.
Of two of his men? His right-hand man asked.
The number is significant.
How?
We're getting a new police commissioner. Gregory can't afford to fight a war. He knows he went too far. Now, he's apologizing. He's making peace. He knows he was in the wrong. Now he's trying to make it right. He's making it 6-4 in our favor, as a gesture, so we don't have to do it ourselves. He's showing that he agrees with us. He agrees we should be ahead in the count.
No one responded. No one could. Dino got up and walked out. The others heard his footsteps click through the outer office and through the big corrugated shed. They heard his driver start his car. They heard it drive away. The yard went quiet. At first, no one spoke. Then someone said,
"An offering?"
Silence for a moment.
You see it different? The right-hand man asked. We would never do a thing like that. Therefore, neither would Gregory. Why would he?
You think Dino is wrong? A huge, dangerous question. The guy looked all around.
I think Dino is losing it, he said. A Viking funeral pyre? That's crazy talk.
Those are bold words.
Do you disagree with them?
Silence again. Then the right-hand man shook his head.
No,
he said. I don't disagree. I don't think it was a sacrifice or an offering.
Then what was it?
I think it was outside interference.
Who?
I think someone killed those guys here so Gregory would blame us for it. He'll attack us. We'll attack him back. We'll end up destroying each other for someone else's benefit, so someone else can move in on both our turf. I think that might be the intention.
Who?
The guy asked again.
I don't know.
But we're going to find out.
Then we're going to kill them all. They're completely out of line.
Dino wouldn't sign off on that. He thinks it's an offering. He thinks everything is sweetness and light now. We can't wait.
Are we not going to tell him?
The guy asked. The right-hand man was quiet a beat. Then he said,
No, not yet. He would only slow us down. This is too important.
Are you the new boss now?
Maybe.
If Dino has really lost it. Which you said first, by the way. Everyone heard you.
I meant no disrespect, but this is a very big step. We better be sure we know what we're doing. Otherwise, it's a betrayal. The worst kind. He'll kill us all.
Time to choose up sides, the right-hand man said. Time for us all to place our bets. It's either Viking rituals, or it's some out-of-towner's takeover bid, which will kill us all faster than Dino could anyway. The guy didn't speak for 10 long seconds. Then he said,
What should we do first?
Put the fire out, haul the wreck to the crusher, then start asking around. Two cars drove in,
One was a big, shiny Lincoln. Someone will remember the other one. We'll find it. And we'll find the guy who was in it. And we'll make him tell us who he's working for.
At that moment, Reacher was four streets away, in the front parlor of a battered row house owned by a musician named Frank Barton. Barton was Abby's friend in the east of the city. Also present in the house was Barton's lodger, a man named Joe Hogan, once a U.S. Marine, now also a musician. A drummer, to be exact. His kit took up half the room. Barton played the bass guitar. His stuff took up the other half. Four instruments on stands, amplifiers, giant loudspeaker cabinets. Here and there among the clutter were narrow armchairs, thinly upholstered with stained and threadbare fabrics. Reacher had one, Abby had one, and Barton had the third and last. Hogan sat on his drum stool. The white Toyota was parked outside the window. Barton said, "This is crazy, man. I know those guys. I play the clubs over there. They never forget. Abby can't go back there ever again."
"Unless I find Trulenko," Reacher said.
"How will that help?"
"I think a defeat of that magnitude would change things a little."
"How?"
Reacher didn't answer. Hogan said, "He means the only route to a high-value target like Trulenko will be straight through the top levels of the organization. Therefore, afterward, the remaining survivors will be no better than low-level drones running around like chickens with their heads cut off. The Albanians will eat them for breakfast. They'll own the whole city. What the Ukrainians were once upon a time worried about won't matter a damn anymore, because the Ukrainians will all be dead." Once a U.S. Marine. A sound grasp of strategy.
"This is crazy," Barton said again.
"Six chances before the week is over," Reacher thought.
Chapter 22. Gregory's right-hand man knocked on the inner office door and entered and took a seat in front of the massive desk. He ran through what he knew. Two guys had been deployed outside Abigail Gibson's house. They were now missing. They were not answering their phones. Their car was no longer where it should be. Gregory said,
"Dino? Maybe not."
"Why?"
"Maybe this was never Dino. Not at first, anyway. We made certain assumptions. Now we need to take a fresh look at the facts. Think about the first two. Who got in the wreck up at the Ford dealer? Who was their last known contact?" "They were doing an address check on Erin Shevik."
"And who was observed flirting with the waitress outside of whose house two more guys just disappeared?"
"Erin Shevik." "No such thing as a coincidence."
"Who is he?"
"Someone is paying him to set you and Dino at each other's throat. So that we destroy each other. So that someone can take over."
"Who?"
"Shevik will tell us. When we find him."
The Albanians hauled the smoking wreck to the crusher, and then they started asking around. The inner council, the top boys, unused to legwork. Their question was fairly simple. "Did you see a two-vehicle convoy, one of which was a Lincoln town car?" No one lied to them. They were pretty sure about that. Folks had seen what happened to people who lied to them. Instead, everyone racked their brains. But results were disappointing, partly because the concept of the convoy was sometimes hard to grasp. During rush hour, for instance, there were no two-car convoys. There were 102-car convoys. Anywhere downtown, at the best of times, maybe 22 car. Who knew which two were the convoy in question? People didn't want to give the wrong answer. Not when the top boys were asking. So a different way was found to ask the same question. It was quickly agreed that among the traffic there had been a handful of black Lincolns, probably six in total. Three of them had been the fat-ass kind the Ukrainians drove.
The top boys encouraged detailed descriptions of what had been in front of each of them and what had been behind. There was a two-car convoy in there somewhere. Three separate witnesses remembered a small white sedan with a hanging-off front fender. In each report, it was ahead of one particular Lincoln, which seemed attentive to its lane changes and such, definitely as if following it, coming out of the west of the city, heading east. The two-car convoy. The small white sedan was maybe a Honda, or the other H, Hyundai, or maybe Kia. Was there another new brand? Or maybe it wasn't a new brand at all, because it was a pretty old car. Could have been a Toyota. Yes, that was it. A Toyota Corolla. Poverty spec. That was the final conclusion. All three witnesses agreed. No one had seen it leave. The top boys put the word out. All eyes open. An old white Toyota Corolla sedan with a hanging-off front fender. Report back immediately. By that point, it was late in the afternoon, which was a respectable time for musicians to start their day. Hogan warmed up with a steady 4-4 beat, hi-hat working, ride cymbal ticking. Barton plugged in a battered fender and turned on his amp, buzzing and humming. He laid down a line, looping and sinuous, staying firmly in the pocket with the kick drum, coming home on the 2 and the 4, launching again on the 1 of the new measure. Reacher and Abby listened for a spell, and then went to find the guest room. It was upstairs at the front of the house, a small space over the street door, with a round window made of wavy glass that could have been 100 years old. The Toyota was directly below. The bed was a queen. The night table was an old guitar amplifier tipped up on its end. There was no closet. There was a row of brass hooks instead, screwed to the wall. The thump of the drums and the bass roared up through the floor. "Not as nice as your place," Reacher said. "I'm sorry." Abby didn't answer. Reacher said, "I asked the guys in the Lincoln where Trulenko was. They didn't know. So then I asked their opinion about a smart first place to look. They said where he works." "Does he work?" "Got to admit, I hadn't thought of it that way." "Maybe in exchange for hiding him. Maybe there's no money left after all. Maybe he's working his passage." "That would be a drag," Reacher said. "Why else would he work?" "Maybe he was getting bored." "Possible." "What kind of work would he do?" "Nothing physical," Abby said. "He looked like a pretty small guy. His picture was in the paper all the time. He was young, but his hair was going, and he wore eyeglasses. He won't be breaking rocks in a quarry. He'll be in an office somewhere, organizing data systems or something. That's what he was good at. His new product was an app on your phone that linked your vital signs direct to your doctor, in real time, just in case, or something like that. Or maybe your watch linked to your phone and then to the doctor. No one really understood it. But anyway, Trulenko is a desk guy, a thinker." "So he's in an office somewhere on the west side of the city, with accommodations either very close by or integrated, with security. Maybe an underground bunker, with a single bottleneck entrance, heavily defended. No one gets in or out except for known and trusted faces. Therefore, you can't get near him." "I agree there will be an element of challenge."
"More like impossible."
"No such word."
"How big of a place would it be?"
"I don't know," Reacher said. "A couple dozen people, maybe. Or more. Or less. Some kind of nerve center, where they send all the texts. You said they were good with technology. There can't be many suitable locations." "See," Reacher said, "we're making progress already."
"No point if the money is gone."
"His employers will have some. I never met a poor gangster."
"The Sheviks can't sue Trulenko's newfound employers. They had nothing to do with it. It's not their fault."
By that point, the spirit of the law might feel more important than the letter.
"You would steal it?"
Reacher moved to the window and looked down. "The capo over there is a guy named Gregory," he said.
I would ask him to consider it a charitable donation for a hard luck story I heard about. I could deploy a number of arguments. I'm sure he would agree. And if he's profiting from Trulenko's labor in some way, then it's almost the same thing as taking Trulenko's own money anyway. Abby got a faraway look in her eyes, and she put her hand up to her cheek, as if automatically.
I heard of Gregory, she said. Never met him. Never even saw him.
How did you hear about him?
She didn't answer, just shook her head.
He said, what happened to you?
Who says anything did?
You just saw two dead bodies. Now I'm talking about threatening people and stealing their money. I'm that kind of guy. We're standing by a queen bed. Most women would be edging out the door by now. You're not. You really, really don't like these people. Must be a reason.
Maybe I really like you.
I live in hope, Reacher said, but I'm realistic.
I'll tell you later, she said. Maybe.
Okay.
What now?
We should go get your bag, and we should go move your car. I don't want it parked right outside. They already saw it at the Shevik house. Someone else might have seen it driving in today. We should go put it somewhere random. Always safer that way.
How long will we have to live like this?
I live like this all the time. I would have been pushing up daisies long ago if I didn't.
Frank said I can't ever go home again.
And Hogan saw how you could.
If you get Trulenko.
6 chances before the week is over. They went downstairs again into the deep bass groove and onward out to the car. Abby wrestled her bag off the rear seat and hauled it back to the hallway. They closed the door on it and got in the car. It started the second time and dragged its fender on the tight turn out of its boxed-in slot. They drove a random zigzag route through different parts of the neighborhood, some of them shabbily residential, some of them commercial, including 2 full blocks dedicated to the construction trade, including an electrical warehouse and a plumbing warehouse and a lumber yard. Then came progressive stages of decay, all the way to abandoned blocks, just like the place where the Lincoln had burned.
Here?
Abby asked. Reacher looked all around. Desolation everywhere. No owners, no occupants, no residents. No innocent doors to get busted down if the car was spotted nearby. No risk of collateral damage.
Works for me, he said.
She parked, and they got out, and she locked up, and they walked away. They went back more or less the same way they had come, cutting the corners off some of the widest zigs and zags of their earlier random route, but always keeping track of it. Their surroundings grew cleaner and better maintained. They came to the blocks dedicated to the construction trade. First stop in the reverse direction came the lumber yard. There was a guy standing in the scoop between the sidewalk and the gate, somewhat sentry-like, maybe there to check loads in and out. Presumably lumber got scammed and stolen like anything else. They passed the guy by and walked on, to the plumbing warehouse, the electrical warehouse, and onward, through a tangle of streets. They heard the bass and drums 100 yards away. The reports came in fast, but not fast enough. One after the other, the members of the Inner Council got hurried calls on their cell phones. An old white Toyota Corolla with a half-off front fender had been seen driving one block, then another. No rhyme or reason in terms of direction. No obvious destination. Generally, it seemed to be headed toward the tumble-down neighborhoods where not even homeless people lived. Then came the pay dirt call. A reliable guy 100 yards away saw the car slow, stop, and park. 2 people got out. The driver was a small woman with short dark hair, in her 20s or 30s, and dressed all in black. Her passenger was a huge guy, about twice her size. He was older, easily 6'5 and 250, built like a brick outhouse and dressed like a refugee. They locked the car and walked away together, and were lost to sight very quickly after the first corner they turned. All that information was shared immediately by calls and voicemails and texts. Fast, but not fast enough. The message got to the guy at the lumberyard gate about 90 seconds after a small, dark-haired woman and a huge, ugly guy had walked right past. Close enough to touch. More minutes were spent getting cars together, and then they streamed away in the direction the couple had been walking. No result. The small woman and the big man were long gone. They had disappeared somewhere in a crowded residential neighborhood, maybe 10 blocks by 10 of shabby row houses packed tightly together, maybe 400 separate addresses, plus basements and sublets, full of deadbeats and weirdos who either came and went at all hours or never went out at all. Hopeless. The top boys put a new word out. All eyes open. A small, dark-haired woman, younger, and a big, ugly guy, older. Report back immediately. Chapter 23. Neither Barton nor Hogan had a gig that night, so they closed down their jam when Reacher and Abby got back and proposed a chill evening in, maybe with Chinese delivery, maybe a bottle of wine, maybe a little weed, some conversation, some stories, some catch-up. Maybe put some records on. All good. Until Abby's cell phone rang. It was Maria Shevik, calling from Aaron Shevik's phone. She and Abby had exchanged numbers, just in case. And this felt like a just-in-case situation. Maria said a black Lincoln Town Car was parked outside her house. Two guys in it, watching. They had been there all afternoon. They looked like they were set to stay. Abby passed her phone to reach her. He said, "They're looking for me, because I mentioned Trulenko. They got worried. Just ignore them." Maria asked, "Suppose they knock on the door?" 70, stooped and starving. He said, "Let them search the house. Show them whatever they want to look at. They'll see I'm not there, and they'll go back to their car. And after that, all they'll need to do is watch the sidewalk. Should be relatively painless." "Very well. Any news on Meg?" "Good and bad," Maria said. "Start with the good," Reacher said. "I think for the first time the doctors truly believe she's improving. I can hear it in their voices. Not what they say, but the way they say it. Their words are always circumspect. But now they're excited. They think they're winning. I can tell." "What's the bad news?" "They'll want to confirm it with tests and scans, which we'll have to pay for first." "How much?" "We don't know yet. A lot, I'm sure. They have amazing machines now. There have been dramatic advances in soft tissue analysis. It's all very expensive." "When will they need it?" "Obviously, half of me wants it to be as soon as possible. And obviously, the other half doesn't." "You should do what is right medically. We'll figure out the rest as we go along." "We can't borrow it," Maria said. "You would have to do it for us because they think you're Aaron Shevik. But now, for you, that would be a trap. Because you asked about Trulenko. Aaron could borrow it under my name, or any name. They're new at this game. They have no system for checking. Not yet, anyway. It's an option, if you need it fast." "You said you could find Trulenko. You said it used to be part of your job." "The question is when," Reacher said. "I figured I had 6 chances before the week is over. Now maybe not so many. I need to work on a faster plan." "I apologize for my tone." "No need," Reacher said. "This is all very stressful." "I can only imagine," Reacher said. They hung up. And Reacher passed the phone back to Abby. Barton said, "This is crazy, man. I'm going to keep on saying it because it's going to keep on being true. I know those people. I play their clubs. I've seen what they do. One time, there was a piano player they didn't like. They smashed his fingers with a hammer. The guy never played again. You can't take them on." Reacher looked at Hogan and asked, "Do you play their clubs?" "I'm a drummer," Hogan said. "I play anywhere they pay me." "Have you seen what they do?" "I agree with Frank. These are not pleasant people." "What would the Marine Corps do about them?" "Nothing," The pointy heads would hand them off to the SEALs. Much more glamorous. The Corps wouldn't get a sniff. What would the SEALs do? A lot of planning first, with maps and blueprints. If we're assuming a hardened bunker of some kind, they would look for emergency exits or delivery bays or incursions by ventilation shafts or water pipes or sewers and places where they could gain access by demolition of walls between adjacent structures. Then they would plan simultaneous assaults from everywhere they could, at least three or four places, with three or four-man teams in each location, which would probably get the job done, except it might be hard to keep any single person of interest alive. There would be a lot of crossfire. It would depend on dimensions and visibility. Reacher asked, "What were you in the Corps?" "Infantry," Hogan said. "Just a plain old jarhead." "Not a bandsman?" "That would have been too logical for the Corps." "Were you always a drummer?" "I was as a kid. Then I stopped. Then I took it up again in Iraq. Every big base had a kit lying around somewhere. I was advised I would enjoy creating patterns I alone controlled. I was advised I would find it helpful, since I could already play a bit anyway. Also, I was advised it would get rid of aggression."
"Who advised you?"
"Some old sawbones. I laughed it off at first. But then I found I was really enjoying it again. I realized I should have been doing it all my life. I've been playing catch-up ever since, trying to learn. I missed a few years."
"You sounded pretty good to me."
"Now you're blowing smoke. And trying to change the subject. You're one guy. You're not a SEAL team."
"I'll figure it out."
"By definition, there must be a dozen better plans than what the Navy would come up with. All I need to do is find the guy."
"There can't be many suitable locations," Abby said again.
Reacher nodded and went quiet. The conversation bounced around him. The other three seemed to be good friends. They had worked together now and then, in the fluid world of clubs, and music, and dance, and men in suits on the door. They all had stories, some of them funny, and some of them not. They seemed to draw no distinction between the Ukrainians and the Albanians. They seemed to think that working east and west of center was equally good and bad. A kid in a car brought Chinese food. Reacher shared hot and sour soup with Abby and sweet and sour chicken with Barton. They drank wine. He drank coffee. When he finished, he said, "I'm going for a walk." Abby said,
"Alone?"
"Nothing personal."
"Where?"
"West of center. I need to hurry this up. The Sheviks are about to get hit by another big bill. They can't wait."
"Crazy man," Barton said.
Hogan didn't speak. Reacher got up and stepped out the front door.
Chapter 24. Reacher walked west, toward the nighttime glow of the tall downtown buildings, the banks and the insurance companies and the local TV, and the chain hotels, all clustered astride Center Street, all penetrated by one faction or the other, all probably unaware of the fact, at management level. Unless the manager was also the mole. Along the way, he passed bars and clubs and storefront restaurants. Here and there, he saw men in suits on the door. He ignored them. Wrong faction. He was still east of center. He walked on. If he had eyes in the back of his head, he would have seen one of the men in suits think hard for a second and then send a text. He walked on. He crossed Center Street three blocks north of the first tall building into a neighborhood no different, with bars and clubs and storefront restaurants, some of them with men in suits on the door, just the same, except the suits were different, and the ties were silk, and the faces were paler. This time he watched them all carefully, from the shadows when he could, looking for the kind of guy he wanted, which was alert, but not too alert, and tough, but not too tough. There were several candidates. In particular, three looked good. Two were in wine bars, and one was in some kind of a lounge, maybe a comedy club. Reacher chose the one sitting nearest the street door, a tactical advantage. It was the lounge. The guy was right inside the glass. Reacher walked toward him,
three quarters in his field of vision. The guy noticed the movement, turned his head. Reacher stopped walking. The guy stared. Reacher moved on again, straight toward him. The guy remembered. Texts, descriptions, photographs, names. Aaron Shevik, be on the lookout. Reacher stopped again. The guy pulled out his phone and jabbed at it. Reacher pulled out his gun and aimed it. One of the two H&K P7s taken from the guys in the Lincoln, before it burned up. German police issue, beautifully engineered, steely and hard-edged. The guy froze. Reacher was three steps away, just enough time. Tempting. The guy dropped his phone and put his hand up under his armpit to get his own gun. Not enough time. The guy was right inside the door, right inside the glass. Reacher got to him before his gun was halfway out, and he pressed the H&K's muzzle against his right eye.